Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Tax Tuesdays. This is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
All right, so let's jump on in. First off, always feel free to follow us on YouTube and Facebook. The YouTube channel is one of the more beneficial resources that's out there on tax and asset protection, and it's a free cost. I mean, it's a free service, so you can absolutely do that. And the Facebook, you're always going to be notified. We actually do a lot of giveaways and things like that on there too. So you're always notified when new stuff is up, and you have coffee with Carl. You have a whole bunch of Tax Tuesdays. Clint Coons is always he produces a lot of content as well. So feel free to jump onto those. As for Tax Tuesday, you can always send in your questions. Nothing else has changed. Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. In fact, that's where we grabbed our questions for today. If you need a detailed response, something very specific to you that's not a general question, you'll need to be a platinum client or a tax client at Anderson for us to answer. And we always let you know, hey, we're able to go this far for free, and then here's where you may want to retain us. And this is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate in the world of finance and the world just in general. Our biggest expense, more than on average, I can just tell you that, it's greater than your clothing, your food, and your shelter combined, is taxes. So it's a great place to start to reduce your outgoing money and keep more of it in your pocket. So let's go on. Opening questions. I recently retired from my job and had a direct rollover into a traditional IRA to self-direct the account and buying real estate properties. So you had a rollover probably from a 401k into a self-directed IRA. Is it better to convert the account now to a Roth IRA for tax purposes, since I'm anticipating expanding my real estate venture in the future, which will benefit me more in terms of taxes when I sell the property? So we'll answer that. I have my personal home and rural land in my personal name and want to be able to isolate it from future ventures, as well as be able to pass it over to my sons when the time comes. I have an LLC that was established a year ago without any holdings. It is registered here in Colorado. Do I use this existing LLC on the ranch or go with a trust and use the LLC for a future real estate move? We'll answer that. Does anyone know or aware of what would happen if I quit claim or transfer title of my personal real property that's a rental into my LLC? How does it affect the existing mortgage on it? The mortgage is under my personal name. Will the lender force a due on clause or disallow? We'll answer that. I have a property in a Wyoming LLC. Anderson Advisors must have set it up. I am preparing to sell the property, my first time to sell a property in an LLC. Suggestions on how to do this for my best tax advantage. Any other advice you can provide me will be much appreciated. We'll answer that. Can you ever do a 1031 exchange for tax lien certificates? Are free and clear properties tax heavier? I'm closing one business and starting another. The company I'm closing owns two vehicles. What is the best way to deal with these? I have one company buy them from the other or buy them personally. We will use them in the new business. Is it more advantageous for the company to own them or for us to own them and take the mileage deduction? The company is an S-Corp. We used bonus depreciation 2 years ago, and there are loan balances on both vehicles. So we'll go through those. I recently tried to open a new account in a Delaware LLC and was told the state of California passed new law in July 2019 requiring that an LLC from Delaware, Wyoming, or Nevada must be registered in California as well. This would remove the benefit of filing in one of the three states, thereby removing the veil of anonymity. We'll answer that. What are the tax consequences of borrowing money from a private lender and agreeing to pay a fixed percentage over time? We'll certainly go over that. And what itemized deductions will be allowed for 2019 returns? Last two questions. The best vehicle to use for retirement without paying taxes on? The last one, I've just started trading weekly stock options. It's my sole source of income. How hard will taxes hit? What can I do to minimize? So we'll go through all those, Jeff.
All right.
Looks like we have our work cut out for us. I always think that I only grabbed a few questions, and then every time I read through them, I realize it's more than a few.
Some of these questions are pretty long, too.
Yeah. Speaking of long, actually, I think that one of the longest questions size-wise is coming up. I actually had to format my screen differently. Okay, I recently retired from my job and had a direct rollover into a traditional IRA to self-direct the account into buying real estate properties. Is it better to convert the account now to a Roth IRA for tax purposes, since I'm anticipating expanding my real estate venture in the future, which will benefit me more in terms of taxes when I sell the properties? What say you, Jeff?
The Roth conversion question is always a difficult one because it depends on circumstances so much. If he thinks he's going to be profitable in the real estate with the real estate properties, then yeah, I think it'd probably be a good idea to do that conversion. However, he's going to have to keep in mind that he is going to have to pay tax on that conversion. So if this is going to be a low income year, then I might go ahead and do that Roth conversion. If he just retired in the current year, he may want to wait until the next year where his income may be a little lower.
So it gets kind of interesting. When you actually do this over a time horizon and the taxes are equal, there's no difference between a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA. And the reason that is when I put money into a 401k or a traditional IRA, I've taken a tax benefit, and that bumps the value of my account up. I have to add that back in when comparing it to a Roth, where there is no tax benefit. So if I put $5,000 in a traditional IRA, depending on what tax bracket I'm at, I may have saved an extra $1,000. So I have to look at that when I'm comparing it to a Roth. So I'd end up comparing $6,000 over a time horizon to $5,000 over a time horizon. And then when I retire, I'm taking money out of the Roth tax-free, but I'm going to pay tax on the traditional IRA as I'm taking it out, or 401k. Anything right. Where I have qualified money where I'm going to pay tax on it. I'm going to have to take a distribution out. I'm going to be required at 70 and a half. I'm going to have to take this money out, and I'm going to have to pay tax on it. So the big question is, what's going to be my tax bracket? So the fear mongers out there say, well, you think taxes are going up, or you think they're going down? Up or down? Well, regardless of what the tax, you know, whether they go up or down percentage wise and how the brackets work, the real question is, what's your income going to be and where are you going to fall on those brackets? So if I'm in the top bracket right now, usually like over a time horizon, it's going to benefit me to get a big tax deduction now. And if my taxes are going to be lower when I retire, then I'm actually going to be better off doing a traditional. Of course, if I'm in the 37, I probably can't do a traditional IRA. I'm phased out, but I'm going to do a 401k or whatnot. So not to make this too convoluted, but all things being equal, they're about equal. So the question to you then is, are you in a high tax bracket so that if you do this conversion that you're paying a higher tax amount? So if your taxes are going to stay relatively equal, it's a push. If your taxes are going to go down when you retire, in other words, you're in your prime earning years, then don't do the conversion. It's really hard to make up that money. So for example, if I convert that money and I'm in the 22% tax bracket, I just took a 22% haircut. I'm going to have to make about 30% back just to break even. And for those of you guys that understand the math, if I have a 20% haircut on $100, it means there's $80 left. If I have a 20% gain that year, 20% of 80 is 16. I'm at $96. I'm still not back to my 100. I have to make more. So a lot of people make this too simplistic. They always say, just do the Roth. It's always better. No, over a time horizon, like if I have 40 years, I'm a young person. Absolutely. It's really going to be like I'm in a really low tax bracket as a young person, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. And that money's going to grow. I didn't pay much tax on it, and it's never going to pay tax again. If I'm in a high tax bracket, I do a Roth, and I had to pay tax on every dollar that went in there, I just devalued that, and I passed up a tax deduction to do it, then I'm probably, unless I have my time horizon is 15 years, it's really tough to make it back. So I'm sorry to give you a kind of a convoluted answer. I'm looking at it saying, hey, if you left you recently retired, if you're in a low tax bracket, I don't even know if I convert. I'm going to have to do the numbers. You got to get got to get your pen and paper out. And just remember that in real estate, if I was buying that in my individual name, I'd be taking the depreciation. If I'm buying that in an IRA, I'm giving that up. So there better be some tax benefit for me to be doing that. So I'm going to be looking at that. Otherwise, I'm going to do it outside. And if you say, hey, where am I going to get the money? It's all in my IRA. Well, look at opening up a 401k and borrow the money out. Like, you could do that too. Anyway, enough to, I think we killed that turkey.
That horse has been beaten to death.
Well, I just did the TaxWise workshop this last week, and I crunched the numbers because I said there's a lot of conventional wisdom out there, and they always tell you to do something. And I was crunching the numbers, and on some of the people, it was hurting them, and they were fighting to do it because somebody told them this was a good thing. And I would say, all right, what's your tax bracket? What's your level of, you know, how much are you making in this thing? And I'd plug those numbers in, and they were usually sitting there looking at you dumbfounded when they were worse off by doing the conversion. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's, the reality is that you have to factor in what's the tax hit, right? I have my personal home and rural land in my personal name. So it sounds like they have a ranch, and I want to be able to isolate it from future ventures as well as be able to pass it over to my sons when the time comes. I have an LLC that was established a year ago without any holdings. So it sounds like we're just going to assume that the LLC hasn't done anything. It is registered here in Colorado, so it's a Colorado LLC. Do I use this existing LLC on the ranch or go with the trust and use the LLC for future real estate move? What say you, Jeff?
Well, a lot of times this ranch sounds like it may be a working ranch, so it may be a business within itself. Mm-hmm. And their residence is also on the ranch.
Well, it doesn't say that. I looked at that too. I said my personal home and rural land in my personal name. You know, so it doesn't say the personal house is on the rural land. It could be that there's two parcels here, which changes it a little bit. I'm just going to throw that
right at
you.
So if it's two different parcels, I think I would probably throw the ranch part of that in the LLC.
I would agree with that 100%. And you're going to have to use the Colorado LLC. I may use the existing since it was already filed, depending on what it did.
Right. Now, if they're a combined property, I don't know if I want to parcel that out separately. Mm-hmm. He does say he wants to pass it on to his son. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that the 121 exclusion is not in play here.
Well, the 121 won't get destroyed by a single owner LLC. What an LLC sometimes does is destroys any homestead. I'm not familiar with the Colorado homestead, but I'm sure we could probably look it up pretty quick. So the big, you know, if that's not a big issue, sometimes you throw it in the LLC if it's worth a lot and you have other outside activities that you're afraid may cause it to go away. If you just want to keep it and you want to keep it in the family, then you may do a QPERT or a Qualified Personal Residence Trust where you throw it in there if it's all one parcel. That way you don't have to worry about anybody ever taking it away. In any case, the LLC is for asset protection. The trust is for the estate. And so you say, should I use an existing LLC or go with a trust? You're actually doing both. The LLC is great for the ranch. The trust is what keeps you out of probate. Mm-hmm. And so no matter what you're doing, I'm doing the trust. And again, I don't want to make too many assumptions, but let's say this is two parcels, your personal house. I'm putting the personal house in a living trust, and I'm putting the second parcel, if it is a second parcel, in an LLC. And that LLC will be owned by you as trustee of your living trust. It'll be in your living trust as well. And that'll get you where you want to be. And if you want to freeze it for your kids, like sometimes you say, I want to be able to pass it on, and then the kids get it and immediately sell it, which is okay. They have a basis step up. They're not going to pay any tax on it when you pass. But that may not be what you want. If you want that ranch to stay in your family, we may want it to be held in a trust without distribution rights. Mm-hmm. And saying that you want to keep that. You don't want to liquidate that asset. You want to hold it for the benefit of your future generations. And that way somebody can't, without unilaterally, they couldn't just do it. I'd have an outside trustee look at it and say, why you want to sell this thing?
Right.
If they say, because we hate it, we don't want to ever go there again, then you're probably going to sell it. But if they say, you know, I really want to buy a Maserati and buy some season tickets to my favorite football team or whatever, they're probably going to say no.
And you know, I've seen a lot of times talking about if they don't want their children to sell, I've seen people try to put it in the wills and stuff like that.
Will doesn't
and it
want
notoriously
it.
Fails.
You know, you just hit the nail on the head on that one, Jeff. The wills is a distribution vehicle. A trust is a holding vehicle and an estate planning vehicle. So if you want to give the property to your kids with no strings attached, you put it in a will. You're going to have to probate it. If you want to just give it to your kids, no strings attached, you could use a trust to avoid the probate and then just immediately distribute it. If you want to hold that piece of property in your family, then you use the trust
right. And
you don't distribute it. You just hold it in the trust. And that's just up to your drafter. It's not hard. It's actually pretty straightforward. You use plain language. Everybody thinks it's magic. Lawyerese. No, you're covering your bases. You want to make sure that, you know, you don't stick them with something that nobody wants to use and it sits there and, you know, falls in disrepair and, you know, it's so far off the beaten path that nobody ever is going to use it. You want it to be for the enjoyment of your family, But you could just say, hey, it's really my wishes that this stays in for future generations. We want you guys to meet there. You know, we always want someone to reside there. Please don't make this into a rental. You know, people have the right to, you know, maybe the eldest has the right to occupy, or, you know, you use some methodology. Obviously, if you have sons, it may not be a situation like, again, I have to use an assumption that if the personal home is with the ranch, but if it's just the ranch that you're trying to keep in, then you may be okay if they sell this personal house. They have their own houses, but they keep the ranch in the family. Anyway, there's a lot of moving pieces there. I hope you guys are getting the gist of it. From a tax standpoint, it's neutral. It makes no difference.
Right.
Yeah, so unless that LLC is taxed as a corporation, I'm going to assume that Colorado, if it's single owner, it's going to be disregarded. And Colorado LLCs have been, single owners have been pierced before. So you'd probably want to hold it outside of the state in a separate LLC, probably a Wyoming LLC as a holding entity, holding that one if you had the ranch. But, you know, from the inside liability, it still protects you. From the outside liability, Colorado's not so great. You know, they just had some issues. All right. Here's another one. Does anyone know or aware of what would happen if I quit claim or transfer title of my personal real property that's a rental into my LLC? Yes, we are aware. And how does it affect the existing mortgage on it? The mortgage is under my personal name. Will the lender force a due on clause, probably due on sale clause, or disallow the transfer? What say you, Jeff?
Well, there's a couple things going on here. If you quit claim your title, all you are doing is giving up ownership to the property. It doesn't directly affect your mortgage. You still owe that money on that mortgage. Your name's on it. And the property, to my knowledge, is still secured by that mortgage.
Yeah. So quit claim from a legal standpoint is just my interest. I'm quitting any claim I have against that property and transferring to somebody else. A warranty deed is something else where I'm warranting that I have good title. And the problem that you have when you quit claim a property over to an LLC is that you may void out the title insurance. So it's almost always better to warranty deed it, or some, you know, whatever that county has is saying a little bit more than just I'm giving up my interest. It has no effect on the mortgage from a legal standpoint. That mortgage is still securing. The mortgage is the loan with a security interest on that property to make sure that if the loan isn't paid, then they still have an interest in that property. That predates the transfer. So when you transfer over your interest, it's subject to that existing mortgage. So you don't hurt the mortgage company at all. That said, they usually have a due on sale clause that says if you ever sell this property or transfer it, we have the right to call your note due. Now you're going to say, hey, wait a second, why would I let them know if I'm just putting in an LLC? Yeah, they're not hurt. So I don't even tell them anymore. When you ask them, their heads usually spin around because all they know is it's not in your name anymore, and they tend to freak out. Even if you did it to a living trust, even if you did it to a land trust or whatever else, they still, their knee-jerk reaction is, this is bad. Now, you put it in a living trust or a land trust, you do have statutory protections. It's called the Garden St. Germain Act, and it says that if you're moving a property into a trust in which you're going to reside, then they can't call the note due. There's actually protection from you, or you have protection against them calling it due, even if you transfer it. But that's for, its intent was to, for personal houses. This is a rental property. Obviously, technically, they could exercise their due on sale. That said, in 20-something years, I've seen it done once, and all they said is, hey, we want a loan directly to the entity, and we want you to take it out of your name. Or take it out of the LLC and put it back in your name. And that was years ago, before LLCs really, people are now very comfortable with it, understanding that you could have an LLC that's disregarded for tax purposes. You could have an LLC that's a partnership, it's still going on your personal return. It's still you on the hook. Most lenders don't care. In fact, don't even bother them. If you're paying the mortgage, they don't care. It has zero effect on your taxes.
So speaking of paying mortgages, in this case, they moved the rental into the LLC. Mm-hmm. Should the individual continue to pay the mortgage, or would you?
I've never seen it matter.
Okay.
Never seen it matter. I've done, when I say thousands, we've done tens of thousands of these, and I've never seen it matter. I've only seen one time, and it was because the person brought it to the attention of the board saying, hey, I moved this to an LLC. And they said, you did what? Because they don't know if that's your LLC or if you sold it. There's people that, unscrupulous folks in the past that would set up an LLC and they would, you know, and they would transfer the property to the LLC, but it was a different owner of the LLC. So they sold the property and they didn't tell anybody they sold the property. They would do this as a disguised sale so that usually so that you basically kind of like a forced wrap of the mortgage, or because the person was in financial disarray and somebody came in and rescued them and kept making the payment. And people would use land trusts and some things to kind of disguise those. And, you know, I'm of the belief that, hey, if you're going to sell, if you sell it, you need to report the sale, you know, because there's transfer taxes and there's, and you actually have a new equitable owner out of it. That is not this situation. This wasn't a sale. So you don't need to report it. And it works just great. And the people that even did it with the disguise sale, mm-hmm. it still worked great. It's they just weren't, you know, there was a tax that was due that they weren't paying. So I'd always say, like, hey, at least pay the transfer tax. Let them know that the equitable ownership. So if the mortgage company did look, they would know that, you know, it's no longer the previous owner that's on the hook. Then they can yell and scream and say due on sale. Most don't. Most are like, if they're getting paid, they don't really care. I have and by the way, just go back to that one. Just make sure you're not quit claiming it. Talk to your title company if you have title insurance. All right. I have a property in a Wyoming LLC. I am preparing to sell the property. My first time to sell a property in LLC. Suggestions on how to do this for my best tax advantage. Any other advice you can provide will be much appreciated. What say you, Jeff?
Well, it doesn't really matter that it's in your LLC. It's not going to give you a tax advantage. An LLC in itself does not give any kind of tax advantage. It's not a tax entity.
Mm-hmm.
Preparing to sell a property first time. So much of this depends. I don't know. I can't come up with anything that really gives them a good tax advantage.
Well, the only time that I see a good tax advantage is when you have a corporation managing the LLC, in which case, if you have expenses that you haven't taken or expenses from something else, like some other business venture, but you have a legitimate management agreement where you're paying it, it's just going to reduce the amount of net taxable gain or net taxable income out of that LLC. So if this is just one LLC by itself, disregarded, no tax advantage. If this is an LLC that is, you know, that there's 10 other properties all going up into holding LLC, and you have a corporation managing it, and you have a strong tax appetite out of that corporation, it's reimbursing a lot of expenses, maybe you have some other business activity in there, then yeah, it gives you a tax advantage. You can shave off some. And it really depends on whether the sale is short-term or long-term. So whenever I see an LLC and I see a Wyoming LLC and you're selling the property, I'm always kind of like, is it short or is it long? If I see an LLC, I'm usually anticipating that it's long. In other words, you held it over a year. It's long-term capital gains, which is really good tax treatment. If it's short-term, then we definitely, if it's going into an LLC, that LLC that it ultimately is owned by, or that LLC needs to be taxed as an S-corp or a C-corp. We do not want the short-term sales, which are, you know, you'd be considered a dealer, and it's immediate. It's not like how many I did this year. It's what was your intent when you bought that property, facts and circumstances. If they think that, when I say they, if the IRS thinks that your intent was to sell it when you bought it, you're a dealer, and it's ordinary income, there's no depreciation, there's no installment sales. There's all sorts of bad stuff, and it's taxed at your ordinary rate.
Now, if this is investment property and you're planning on buying another property, I would definitely consider a 1031 exchange.
Great.
Especially, well, if it had a gain. If it doesn't have a gain on the sale, then no, you don't want to do a 1031. You want to be able to recognize that loss in the current year.
Yeah, when you do the 1031, you need to use a facilitator.
Yeah.
And they're going to tell you, you need to buy the new property in the same name of the LLC that you're selling. So if you're going to sell the property in LLC, you need to buy a replacement property in that same LLC. Don't be doing it in your individual name and thinking you're going to transfer it over. You're going to need to close in the name of that LLC.
If you're flipping, you're not going to be able to do the 1031 exchange.
Right. So it's not an investment property anymore. You know, when you're a dealer, when you're flipping, you have inventory. You don't have investment property. So it's no different than if you were a grocery store and you're buying your stock in your shelves with, I always say Cheerios, I don't know why, but you're stocking your shelf with Cheerios. You're buying properties, you know, you may be fixing them up, but all you're still just selling them. They're just inventory you're going to sell. So it's not an investment. One thing that Jeff said that's really important, I want to focus on it, is he said if you're selling at a loss, and this is where it gets really interesting. When you sell at a loss, and you have investment property, something that you held for a trade or business, that loss can actually be an active loss, right? You can actually take any passive activity losses from previous years on that property and any loss on that real estate and offset your W-2 income with it. So hopefully this is, you made money and it, hopefully it's, you held it over a year and hopefully you're going to get long-term capital gains, in which case, yay, you have a choice of, do I want to kick the can down the road and do a 1031 exchange or do I want to recognize it? And then even if I recognize it, there's something called a qualified opportunity zone that I could actually, in 180 days, I could actually dump it into something else. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting.
One other thing that came up yesterday, we were talking to a client about a client who was flipping properties, mm-hmm. selling on installment sale. And we had to explain several times that when you do a flip, even if it's an installment sale, you recognize all of your gain.
That year. Yeah. It's inventory. It's like you sold a Cheerios on an installment sale. You recognize that the sale of the Cheerios, not when you get the money.
Right.
That is only for investors, that installment sale
Correct.
Method. Yeah. They probably love you, right?
No, they're not happy with us.
Right. They don't like the bad news, and they usually blame us for the bad news. And it's like, hey, no, this is it. If you were going to, you know, do an installment sale, it's got to be on investment property.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right. Can you ever do a 1031 exchange for tax lien certificates?
This one I'm not sure about. I know the real estate definition is really broad, but I'm not sure the tax lien certificates falls under that umbrella.
Yeah, I would say no. Usually you're using the tax lien. It depends on whether you take title of the property. If you take title of the property, then I believe you could 1031 it. So if you have a tax lien and you end up with the property, or you own the property and you're on title, then you can 1031.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that.
I'm going to look one thing up. I'm just curious. Because usually you get the tax lien, you're going to get the interest they're going to pay you off. So, but different states have different statutes. And I don't think that you're ever going to be able to use it in a tax lien. In fact, there's nothing here that I could see. I was just looking at my 1031 exchange notes and I don't see anything. Yeah. So if you're owning the lien certificate, and all lien is, hey, I have something against that property that I can foreclose on or that can give me equitable title. The 1031 exchange rules changed under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and it's limited to just real estate. And you have to have ownership in real estate. So I don't think you could do it on a traditional tax lien, but if you are on title and you end up owning it because of the tax lien, mm-hmm. then yes, I think you can. But it's still subject to the tax lien.
Yeah, with the 1031s, you have to have a right to the property. Mm-hmm. Whereas the tax liens feels more like security trading.
Yeah, I think we're on 90% on that one. Like there's, okay. You know, so if somebody, what we'll do is we'll probably do a little more research onto it and just see. Are free and clear properties taxed heavier? That was one of my favorite. I looked at it, free and clear, taxed heavier. The only way you're taxed heavier, because it really doesn't matter whether you have, if you have a loan against a property, the only way that it affects you is that you don't have a mortgage interest deduction. That's the only thing, is you don't have that if you're free and clear. You're going to have some expenses that aren't there for somebody who is paying a third party. But the flip side is now you have more money. So it's like, right. Yeah, you're taxed a little heavier because you make more money. I'm not paying a third party a bunch of interest. So no, they're not taxed any differently otherwise.
Yeah, your tax is on your gain, not your proceeds.
Yeah, you know, on both sides to that, by the way. You know, so if I buy a property, you know, I buy a structure, it doesn't matter whether I have debt against it. I'm writing off that structure over a period of years. And the IRS follows the same rules Congress laid out and says, hey, and the IRS gets to prescribe, I believe that it's the IRS that's putting out the time frame on these things. I don't think it's Congress that's necessarily spelling them out. But what it is if you have tangible personal property, it has a life expectancy. So, for example, you know, your carpet may last 5 years. The structure may last 27 and a half, if it's residential, if it's commercial, they say it's going to last even longer. It's going to last 39 years, which means they give you a deduction for that portion every year.
Right.
Now, there's other little rules like, hey, the default is that longer period, but you can elect to separate out those elements in your building. So like it's called a cost segregation. You've heard that a number of times from us. You have to actually change your accounting method and actually elect to do that. That's when you're doing a cost seg and you're making a, what's the election form? 3115?
Yes, 3115.
Yeah, so I say, hey, I'm going to change and I'm going to treat it, instead of one big structure, I'm going to break it out into components.
Right.
So I'm going to have 5-year property, 7-year property, 15-year property, like your sidewalks are 15-year, your driveway is 15 years.
Right.
What's 7-year? I always forget the 7-year.
7 years, like, going to be your cabinets, your your furnishings inside.
Some other pieces. So they let you write off 1/7 every year. But if you do the 3115, you break it down, and then you have further elections you can make. You can do bonus depreciation in year one when you make your election, which means I could take up to 100% of any item that's less than 20 years, right?
Correct.
In year one. So that's why you do a cost seg. If you want to get a bunch of loss generated, you could do that. But again, none of that has anything to do with whether there's debt on the property. So your debt doesn't hurt you, doesn't help you. If you're paying interest, you get to write it off, but you're paying the interest, like you have less money. So I'm closing one business and starting another. This is an interesting one, by the way, Joe. We were just in the minutes before we started, we're just kind of bantering back and forth. So closing one business and starting another. The company I'm closing owns two vehicles. What is the best way to deal with these? Have one company buy them from the other or buy them personally? Will we use them in the new business? Is it more advantageous for the company to own them or for us to own them and take the mileage deduction? The company is an S corp. We used bonus depreciation 2 years ago and there are loan balances in both vehicles. What say you, Jeff?
In my experience, it's always cleaner to sell them rather than distribute them. Now, it's possible that the the loan balances on the automobiles are close to the value of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And by value, I mean the fair market value, not what the cost basis is, because it looks like these vehicles have no cost basis anymore, but the bonus depreciation.
So the bonus depreciation just means that if these vehicles qualified, would they have taken 100% or would they have been limited to the 18,000?
If they took it 2 years ago, it would have been only 50%.
Yeah. So
bonus.
So it depends. I'd have to look at the depreciation schedule, but the question is, did I write it off on paper? So assuming that what they're saying is, hey, we use bonus depreciation and we wrote these things off. If it is bonus depreciation, that's much better than if they'd use 179.
Right.
179 is this equipment write-off for heavy equipment. And if your use during that period falls below 50%, which if they close the business, obviously it does for that business, you have to recognize all that depreciation you took as ordinary income. So you're going to have a tax hit on the amount that you wrote off.
And the same will happen if they sell the vehicles and they want somebody to buy them.
Yeah. So it's going to stink all over. They're going to have recapture. They'll still write them off over the regular 5-year period. So they'll get, in this case, 2/5 of the deduction. And they'll have ordinary income on 3/5 of the deduction. On bonus depreciation, you don't have that same issue, but you have ordinary recognition on the fair market value. If I take it from the company and give it to a shareholder or somebody, you just gave them an asset of value, you're going to pay tax on that. And if you dissolve a company, assuming it's an S corp, then they're going to treat it as a distribution to you. So you're going to pay ordinary income on it. And just keep in mind that it's based on its fair market value. So, if you bought this at 50 and you wrote it all off and it's worth $20,000, you're going to pay tax on $20,000.
Which is where the loan comes into play, because if you're also taking on a loan of $20,000, your distribution has netted out to zero.
Really? So if you take the loan, so basically it has no value.
Right. You've got nothing of value. You've taken a loan of $20,000 and you've taken a vehicle with a fair market value of $20,000.
So you have to look at it. This is where you have to get your pencil out and gosh. Every time we have these discussions, I feel like people on the other side are going, oh, great. These guys are geeks. This is the rule is what what they want is the IRS always looks at it and says you're supposed to pay tax on exchange of value.
Right. Right.
So if I give a shareholder something of value, I have to look at what that value is. So I can't just buy a car, depreciate it, write it all off and hand it to a shareholder and say, you know, nothing happened, you know, no tax implication. No, you got to look at it and say, what kind of car, how much is it worth? Like Jeff just said, is there debt on it? Like, did I really give the shareholder anything of value? So if I give you a $20,000 car that's subject to a $20,000 mortgage, you know, I gave you nothing. I gave you something of that zero value. So there's no tax hit. That gets us to the second point. If you have a new company, if they bought it, you know, again, all this is dependent on the facts and circumstances. We got to look at what kind of car and all that fun stuff. Is it over 6,000 pounds? But assuming that it's equipment and it meets the definition, it's a Escalade, you know. When the new company buys it, it can immediately depreciate it. You'd have tax hit on the income,
right?
But they'd offset each other. You'd be at zero. So right. it all comes back down to chances are, under this scenario, depending on what those loans are, you probably don't have a tax hit. And then the question is, would I be better off just keeping these individually and doing the mileage? And that's just a personal preference. Some people want the immediate deduction. If it's an ordinary passenger vehicle, I'm probably always going to go with mileage reimbursement. A lot of accountants want to do the actual expense method. I just find it dealing with clients that they tend not to track things so well. I can say, put on your Mile IQ on your phone and let me, you know, and keep track of your business, you know, once a month, just stop. And I think you swipe left for business, right for personal, whatever it is, but you're just going back, you know, and just keeping track that way. Maybe every week, maybe you're technically probably supposed to do it every day, but just make sure that you're doing it periodically and keeping track of these things so that now we know how many miles. And then based off of that number, that then you reimburse yourself, write yourself a check and boom, you're done.
Yep.
If you're doing any other method, you've got a lot more heavy lifting. And if it's in the company, and these guys may have learned this, you have a different type of insurance. You're going to be dealing with not necessarily fleet insurance, but definitely commercial insurance, and it's going to be more expensive. So it's so much easier to have personal insurance on a vehicle, reimburse the miles. I'm not worried about dropping below 50%. I'm not worried about recapture of depreciation. I don't have to worry about any of that. I just have to worry about how many miles did I drive and is it 58 cents per mile that I get to reimburse myself. And I don't have to report it. Like me personally, I don't have to show it on my tax return.
And any of you wanting to go out and buy Elon Musk's new Tesla pickup truck, you're going to be chasing your tail in circles trying to figure out which is the best way to go with
that. Because even like the X qualifies, it's so heavy, qualifies over the 6,000 pounds, so you can bonus depreciate that. If you bought one right now at the end of the year, you can write it off against your company.
Yeah.
If your company has a bunch of income, maybe you do that. But just keep in mind, anytime you have a company car, you're supposed to pay tax on the personal use. And it's based off of what percentage of the lease value you're using. So you still have to track the miles.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. We could go down a rabbit hole on this one. Actually, I think we already did. All right. I recently tried to open a new account with the Delaware LLC and was told that the state of California had passed a new law in July 2019 that required that an LLC from Delaware, Wyoming, or Nevada be registered in California as well. This would remove the benefit of filing in one of the three states, thereby removing the veil of anonymity. No, there's not a bunch of new stuff. What it is if you're going to own real estate, I believe the LLC is considered doing business and they're going to require you to register. But you've always been required to register if you're doing business in a state. And that's subject to that state's definition, subject to the Constitution, which says you can't force someone to register and do business if it's kind of transitory. But if your touchings are enough, then the state can. It's always that kind of that push and pull of the federal law versus the state not wanting to interfere with interstate commerce and all that fun stuff. But a lot of people would, you know, they do this, hey, let's set up a Delaware, Wyoming, or Nevada because they think that there's going to be anonymity and all this fun stuff. And then they go, it's going to do business in California and North Carolina or whatever else. It's so much cleaner to have an entity in that state, wherever you own the real estate. And it could be an LLC, it could be a land trust, it could be any number of things. But
and California is one of those states that has kind of a built-in anonymity. If you ever go and try to look up a property to see who owns it, you're not going to find it.
In California. Tough, depending on the county.
Yeah, I think all the counties that I've dealt with in California, none of them present ownership. No, I'm sure that the attorneys can get to it.
No, you can get to it for sure.
And lawsuit.
The entities you can absolutely see. The way that you get anonymity in California, here I'll give you two things just because sounds like that's an issue, is number one, use a land trust. And instead of having you as a trustee, use either an entity or a third party. That way, your name's not on the property. But you'd have to buy it in the name of the land trust. Or if you transfer it, you'll still be in a chain of title, but you won't be the name that there's if they search who's the current owner, things like that. But if you want an entity to be anonymous in California, you have to start with a parent entity in a state that has anonymity. Now, between Delaware, Wyoming, and Nevada, I'm going to pick Wyoming right now. It's the cheapest. It has the same statute as Nevada. And Nevada and Wyoming are both better than Delaware because it's better for you, the manager or the one who owns the property. Delaware is designed really to promote investment in the company, which means there's strong rights for anybody who gets a hold of a company or is an interest in a company. In other words, it's not necessarily, it's creditor good. And it's a great place if you're a creditor, which is the opposite of what you want if you're the real estate holder. So I'm going to say Wyoming. And Wyoming doesn't have your name listed in it. And so if you open up an LLC in California, your name's going to be all over it. You're going to get subject to a franchise tax, too. It's going to suck. But the easier route is to have the Wyoming entity actually set up a child LLC in your home state. And if you did it that way, the member may be listed, which is a Wyoming LLC, which does not have your name listed on it. So you've accomplished the anonymity that way.
And this has actually come up recently with California asking for Form 568, which is the report of information for the single member LLCs. And the clients are saying, well, but we have to identify who the owner of that LLC is.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to what you were saying. It's your Wyoming or Nevada LLC holding company who doesn't have to disclose who owns them.
There's that one. And then, I never want to think, I never want to mislead somebody. Hey, you're not going to get away from the franchise tax. California's going to hit you no matter what. It's just whether you can limit it to one entity that you own, and then that's your sacrificial lamb, maybe two. But you don't want to necessarily have a bunch of LLCs in California simply because, A, it's $800 minimum, plus if it's an LLC, there's a gross receipts tax that starts to hit you too. So if I have real estate in California, more than likely I'm using a land trust and I'm going to use a out-of-state LLC that might have be a beneficiary of the trust. I'm probably not doing a whole bunch of LLCs, and I'm going to have to think real long and real hard as to whether I use a limited partnership versus an LLC. If I'm generating nothing but huge gains, I'm probably using an LP. But all those are little factors that you're playing with. But going back to their question, no, there's nothing really new. It's what California is doing is it's just trying to make sure that there's no shenanigans, because there's bad actors out there who are, literally, you have a Delaware entity that owns a California property and they're not registered in the state. No, that's been the law for a really long time. You're just ignoring the law. And California and the Board of Equalization and the Secretary of State, they're saying, hey, don't ignore our laws. We're going to make it much more clear now. And whether or not a law is particularly constitutional or not is something out there you get to argue. Franchise Tax Board is notorious for losing its cases and then just modifying the law slightly and losing that case too. And then, but they're really good at trying to take your money. And if you ask them, they'll always say, yeah, pay me.
And nobody likes the $800 fee, except for the state of California.
It's a tax.
But I kind of look at it as it's a cost of doing business in California.
That's it. You get a protection. It's better than having somebody take everything you own. That's for sure. And in California, those verdicts are huge. You don't want to mess around with it. You could have worst case that could happen. You have a house that you have $50,000 of equity and you're up to your eyeballs in debt. And you think that maybe someday it's going to be worth something in California because there's nothing that really cash flows there. But let's just say that you got it and somebody sues you for a couple million dollars for mold. I mean, the verdicts are huge. I mean, even Ed McMahon, we used him as an example. He had think on his home, he got $7 million, $7.9 million, because they said that there was mold and it poisoned his dog. So you can Google that one, by the way. But there's really big cases. What's the worst case scenario? I have $50,000 of equity. They're not worried about that equity. They're going to take everything else you own. So you want to make sure you have an LLC wrapped around it under any circumstance. Moving on, what are the tax consequences of borrowing money from a private lender and agreeing to pay a fixed percentage over time? This is easy for you.
the tax consequences. Well, you get money to do your development, but otherwise you're going to pay that lender back an agreed upon amount, either a percentage of interest or some portion of the profits, which will reduce your gain that you have to pay taxes on.
Yep. So if I am borrowing personally, and it's on the acquisition indebtedness of buying a home or fixing up a home, then I could write that off as a Schedule A deduction. It's an itemized deduction. If I am using a private lender, which more than likely this is a investment property, then that interest is going to offset my income. And it doesn't really matter. The loaning of the money, the borrowing of the money. So I get, let's say I borrow $100,000. That $100,000 is not taxable so long as I'm on the hook to pay it back. If I borrow the money and then they release me from the obligation to pay it back, I have $100,000 of taxable income.
Now, I will say I'm not real crazy about using a private lender for purchase of a private residence, personal residence. However, if you, I know you're going to disagree, but
I've seen people do it. The only difference between a private lender and a bank is that the private lender is usually an individual or somebody who's much quicker and probably doesn't have all the bureaucracy. And it's quite often, I mean, usually they're more expensive. But let's just be straight. If you're using a private lender, it's because you can't get a loan from a bank. But sometimes it's rich uncle who's just loaning money to nephew or niece to buy a house and here giving you a really good interest rate. Here's your 3% loan. Pay me back.
Something that's really important with these private lendings is for your personal residence in particular, you have to give them a security interest in your property.
Mm-hmm.
If you borrow from your uncle or your neighbor or something,
you got to have a mortgage. It's that mortgage. It's a lien against the property.
If the property's not secured, you cannot deduct that interest as mortgage interest.
God, I love having a CPA on this. So great point, because you can't just borrow money and say, like these people were going out and saying, hey, I'm going to borrow money against the equity in my house. All right. You got to make sure that it's actually secured. Otherwise, you can't write it off. And if you're borrowing it for anything other than fixing up the house or buying the house, non-deductible. You know, so when people take the equity out of their house to send their kids to college, that's not deductible.
Right.
If you take the equity out of your house to buy a investment property, you do not. That is not deductible on your Schedule A. That would actually be the investment expense. Yep. And you're going to put that on your Schedule E, right? Fun stuff. This is like excitement. Right. What itemized deductions will be allowed for 2019 returns?
I'm not aware that the itemized deductions have changed from 2018 to 2019. It's basically going to be the same things that could be deducted.
So you're going to look at. You could actually go pull up a Schedule A if you want, but it's going to be medical expenses over 10% of your adjusted gross income. It's going to be mortgage interest on mortgages of $750,000 unless you purchase your property after 2017, after September of 2017.
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's when the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was actually passed. It's going to be charitable giving, subject to an adjusted gross income cap of 60%.
Right, which was an increase in 2018.
That was a nice big one.
Conservation easements was also increased from 30% to 50% in 18.
Nice.
And state and local taxes up to $10,000.
Yep, they call that the SALT deduction. You're going to get that too. Gone are the days when you had phase outs on Schedule A. So that's one good thing. And, you know, when you're looking at the itemized deductions, you really need to compare it to your standard deduction, which is huge now. This year is 2019 is $24,400 for a married couple, $12,200 for a single person. Huge. And their itemized deductions have to exceed that for it to be deductible.
Correct. And gone and beginning in 2018 are the miscellaneous deductions.
Boo. That's what really killed people.
Which included like investment expenses. I know a lot of people were paying substantial amounts for advisor fees.
And I've talked to a few advisors that are dealing with the aftermath of the pissed off client who just recently, you know, realized that they can't write off the 50 grand they paid their advisor.
And then you have the employees who are paying substantial amounts for their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Non-reimbursed
employee expenses.
Yep.
Those are gone. Tax preparation fees, union fees.
You do have the teachers. Like the part that was really frustrating for a lot of us is because we know that teachers are coming out of pocket to buy things for their class. Mm-hmm. I had a number of family members who were lifelong teachers, and they did give you a $250 deduction, right, that you can take.
Which, but from talking to teachers, is almost nothing.
It's nothing. Yeah, they really hosed a lot of people by taking away the miscellaneous. The only way to get around this stuff is, I mean, you got to have a business. You absolutely positively. And if you're a teacher and you're doing things that the government should be doing, then the only thing I can think of is a 501c3. And then you can donate your money. Again, it's itemized deduction. It has to exceed your standard deduction, which the way they pay most teachers, you're probably going to be taking that standard deduction. Like, you're just not getting any benefit for all the good stuff you're doing. So
if you're married, it's hard to beat that $24,000 standard deduction for most.
I think it's 80% now we're taking the standard deduction. So it's a little, like, I didn't want to get into all the tax strategies for the end of the year. For our tax clients, we did a big old live cast. There's some really cool stuff. But one of the things that you need to look at is, if you're somebody who tithes and you're losing the ability to do the tax deduction, you really need to think hard, long and hard about doing a donor advice fund or your own 501c3, or instead of doing annual gifts, do biannual.
Correct.
Every 2 years, so you can get the tax deduction. So what you do is, hey, if my standard deduction, if I add up my state and local taxes, my mortgage and everything ends up being right around 20 grand, and I gave, you know, $5,000 to charity, you're not getting any benefit. Even if I did 2 years, I'm still not getting any benefit because that $24,400 is going to eat it all up. But what if I, you know, did it every 3 years, 4 years, gave assets instead of the cash, mm-hmm. to a, you know, again, I donor advised funds, the easy one, where I make a one-time big old gift, and then I divvy it out over the period of years, and I do that every few years. So it's almost like you create a savings account for your charitable giving, and then you give it to you make the tax transaction, you're just doing it periodically, so you can actually get some tax benefit. Again, you get your pencil out, you get a piece of paper, and you actually do the calculation, you see if it's worth it. So there's the old question is the juice worth the squeeze? And you gotta figure it out for yourself. If you're if you're paying a lot in taxes and you're in a real high bracket, usually yes. If you're in a really low bracket, usually no, but you may as well figure it out.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned, all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
What's the best vehicle to use for retirement without paying taxes on it?
I think we're going to differ on opinions here, but the best and safest without paying taxes, municipal bonds.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm going to say you're not going to put it all into that. But if you want something that you don't have to pay tax, state and local, or state and federal, you do a muni bond, but you're going to get a crappy return is all.
Oh, right. We're looking at 1-2% most times.
Yeah, you know, so you're basically, that's just a hedge against inflation, and thank God we're not paying tax on that. But again, the best vehicle for retirement without paying taxes on it, where if you get a decent return where you can control it, is always going to be real estate. It's going to be non-qualified plans like whole life and IULs. It's going to be stocks you don't pay tax on. A lot of people forget that the only thing you pay tax on when you own stocks is the dividend,
right?
And that's at long-term capital gains rates. And so if you follow Jeff's advice on the munis and you have real estate that's offsetting its own income, you're going to have a tax appetite, which means you can pay zero taxes on long-term capital gains up to about $78,000, and your tax bracket on that dividend that you're receiving is zero if you're in that threshold, and you have a standard deduction. So really, you can go up to about 100 grand and you're still in the 0% tax bracket on anything that's long-term capital gains dividends. So, like, I'm going to say that from a tax standpoint, I'm going to agree with Jeff. Man, muni bonds, great, but they pay out like
horrible.
You also, if you have an IUL, if I need the money, it's tax free. So put, you know, I paid tax on the money going in. So if you built a whole life or an IUL over the years, that's fantastic. If you have real estate, use the depreciation on the real estate and you don't pay tax. Like, Jeff, you do tax returns day out, like you guys did, what, six?
5,000, we're at 5,000 right now.
5,000 right now, and the year's not even over.
Right.
How often do you see the holding LLC actually have positive income that makes tax on real estate? Like, in other words, in English, how often do people actually have to pay taxes on the rents that they're making on their real estate?
Not often, because between mortgage interest and depreciation, it's usually wiping out your revenue.
So that's a great vehicle, because you're getting the cash, mm-hmm. but you're not having to pay tax on it. It keeps you in a low tax bracket. So when you do need money from something like, hey, I have stocks and I have, like, and this is something you should do at the end of the year anyway, you should say, what tax bracket am I in? Do I have any room inside it? If I'm in the 0% tax realm, sell some of your stocks.
Mm-hmm.
People always freak out at this. I just had an advisor meeting yesterday on this. I'm like, guys, tell the clients, if they have a $20,000 long-term capital gains appetite, in other words, I can sell $20,000 of long-term capital gains and pay zero, sell it and buy it right back. Just reset the basis. For everybody that goes out there and says, what about the wash sale rule? You know, that's the for losses only. It's not for gains.
Right.
So I can sell something and buy it back immediately. And I just locked in tax-free money.
Correct.
So even if I don't need it. But if I do need it, and then if I sell it the next year, my basis is higher. I pay almost no tax anyway.
And we've had that conversation with some clients about, well, I've held Boeing for 30 years now.
And I'm like, oh,
sell it, capture your gains, and buy back tomorrow if you want.
Yep, yep. And they're like, but I've had it for 30 years. You still will have it. Just lock it in. It's like selling your house. You don't have to pay tax on a portion of it.
And another thing I want to bring up about the rental property is, I'm going in retirement and I have this rental property. I'm just depreciating mm-hmm. the heck out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But say 10 years later, I pass away and I still own this rental property.
Basis steps up.
None of that depreciation matters anymore.
I don't have any recapture and the basis steps up and I get to start my heirs get to redepreciate
right.
it. Yep. So in that, well, and again, I this isn't something we wanted to necessarily talk about today, but I always look at it and I go, you're crazy if you don't have a big chunk of your estate in real estate. You're absolutely nuts. And then when I say the real estate, I'm saying buy and hold. Don't ever sell it, because you get to depreciate it over and over and over again if you keep it in your name. And worst, like, if I'm sitting here, like I do this, you give it to your own charity. Sell it. Take the deduction. They sell it. They don't have to pay any tax. You don't have to recapture and all this other stuff.
Correct.
And then they can, you know, like, again, I'm a big advocate for if you're going to do your charitable giving and you're like a tither and everything else, it's usually not so great to be doing it just in your individual name. You may want to set up your own vehicle to do it, 501c3, and then you can donate something into it. And now you're actually able to give away more and get a bigger tax deduction. Give away a house every 6-7 years, you know, at fair market value. That's what your deduction is. So pretty effective. So I think we killed that one too. We've been beating a lot of horses. They're going to get some hate mail. I've just started trading weekly stock options as my sole source of income. How hard will taxes hit? What can I do to minimize?
That depends on how good you are at trading your options.
I was thinking bad things. I was like, well, losses are great. You don't have to pay taxes on losses. No, I'm just kidding.
Our first tax advice is keep your losses at $3,000 a year, because you can't write off any more than that.
The only exception is if this is your sole source of income and you're doing it all the time, you could be considered a trader. If you're a trader and you make a mark-to-market election, then you get to take your losses against any other income. But if it's your sole source of income, there's no other income to offset. So what do we care? We'll just carry the losses forward. But assuming that you're making money, and by the way, if you own the stocks and you're selling options, that's a whole different animal. My experience is that the vast majority, like over 80%, make money.
Mm-hmm.
The people that I see lose money in the stock market are the ones trying to time the market, and they don't own the underlying securities. They scare me sometimes just because they're so aggressive, and when they get hit, they get nuked. So, but if it is, and you're selling stock options, and you're buying and selling and buying and selling, short-term capital gains is what an option
right.
is, and it's going to be treated as ordinary income, which means it's going to be your tax bracket, but it will not be subject to Social Security taxes. So it's just going to be your ordinary income. What can you do to minimize that? The recommendation from our firm is going to be to hold your option account in a separate taxable entity, either directly in a C corp, directly in an S corp, or a combination of the two, where you have your stock option account in one entity, like an LLC, that's taxed as a partnership. This is crucial. Either a limited partnership or an LLC taxed as a partnership, and it has a corporation as a general partner. And the reason being is, as Jeff said previously, Investment expenses, you cannot write them off. They're gone. Miscellaneous itemized deductions, gone. The only way you're going to get deductions, if you're like going to events, seminars, conferences, you're doing education, you're paying a coach, you're buying resources. The only way you're writing those things off is if you have a corporation.
Right.
And so, and it needs to be a guaranteed payment to that corporation. So either it owns the account, or if you keep the account where you need to make a living off it and you don't want to get into a bunch of tax issues, you have it in a partnership where the corporation is a partner and it's a guaranteed payment. It's going to lower your net income. So assuming that you're killing it, and I have clients that make seven figures a year in the option market, so but they tend to own the underlying securities. I'll just use that again as a, they're selling covered calls, buying them back, selling them, buying them back. They do callers. They're not sitting there going out there and exposing themselves to massive downside risk. They tend to be very good, and they do one thing over and over again. Like Marque, who teaches infinity investing with us, she plays like two or three companies over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Imagine it gets boring, but you start to see that, you know, you get really familiar with it. So if you're making the money, then the only way you're going to like really have the ability to change it up is to use that a corporation in the mix. And then when you do, if you make a lot of money, you can use a 401k, you can still offset the corporate income by using a solo 401k or something, you know, another vehicle to defer the tax. So it all gets down to how good you are, how much money you're making, and in the vehicle in which it sits. If it's in your name, your options are pretty much nil. So if you're just trading it and it's your sole source of income in your personal name, my recommendation is don't do that. Get it into a vehicle like an LLC with the corporation as a manager, a limited partnership with the corporation as a general partner, or just straight into a corporation, depending on how much you're making. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Woo! All right. Two for Tuesday is going to be ending pretty soon. This is the getting to the end of the year. We just did the last TaxWise workshop. So there's three recordings, 6 days of recordings of the TaxWise workshop. Plus, you get tickets to go to a 3-day tax and asset protection. You get 2 tickets to come out. We teach them all over the country. You can always come out to Vegas and hang out with us in our home offices. We teach them in downtown Summerlin quite often, depending on how big the group is. Sometimes we end up having to go to an outside venue like Red Rock or Green Valley Ranch or the Hard Rock, soon to be closing its doors and becoming Virgin. And there's a 3-part video series and a wealth strategy planning blueprint, a strategy session where we do the wealth planning blueprint. All of these things, you get all the recordings, 6 days. You get 3 days of live class. You get the Tax and Asset Protection for Real Estate Investors book, 3-part video series, and the strategy session for a total of $197. So we're calling that a 2 for Tuesday. Watch for the link. We always send it out. That is a screaming deal. And the best part is if you go to the TaxWise workshop, I've literally had people. This last workshop from this week, it seems like it's longer ago, but right. The last workshop, we had folks in there who had saved $60,000, $68,000. There was somebody in there, 100-some thousand savings, not tax deductions, but actual savings in their pockets from last year. And they were coming back. And I tell them, I said, just walk away with 3 strategies. They implemented the strategies, and usually the results are pretty like mind-blowing. When you understand and you actually put the numbers down over your lifetime, it could save. I mean, hundreds of thousands is an understatement. Usually our average is about $20,000 of deductions per year. And so it depends on your tax bracket. If you're in a 22% tax bracket, it's about $4,400. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it adds up over the years. For our higher net worth folks, last year was around $100,000. So depending on what your tax bracket was, that's the savings. And so, yeah, for a whopping $197, you can check it out and see what we can end up doing for you. We also have our podcast. These Tax Tuesdays are always in there, so you can go back if you can't get enough of listening to Jeff and myself talk tax gibberish for you. I always think of Radio Goo Goo and Radio Gaga from Queen. Go Tax Goo Goo, Tax Gaga, right? If you want more, you can go to iTunes or you can go to Google Play, and it's free. We are firm believers that you educate the populace. You make sure everybody understands what the rules are, but there's no reason to hide it. Make sure everybody's eyes are open, and good things usually happen. Hopefully you're taking it. If you can take it to your accountant, your accountant could come and listen to these and become a better accountant, hopefully. Or you just say, you know what, you could always reach out to us again. There's enough business out there. We're slammed most of the time. So We love to share it. And again, we ask for nothing more than that you take the information and save some money. And if you're going to save the money, that you do right by it. You end up spending it on things that you care about or in helping organizations that you care about. Replays are in your Platinum portal. There's usually a few that are out there for those of you guys who aren't Platinum clients. There's usually a few sessions that you can go watch. I think it's 2 or 3. But if you want to watch, we've done well over 100 episodes at this point. They're sitting in your Platinum portal. You can always follow us on social media, Facebook, YouTube. And then last thing, if you have a tax question, just email us at TaxTuesday at Anderson Advisors. We get hundreds of questions. We're always looking at them. Quite often they're specific to you, so we're not going to put those up on the screen. But we grab the general questions that we think, hey, you know what, this is something that we should answer in front of the group. There's thousands of people registered for Tax Tuesday, so we know we have a lot of listeners. And feedback we get is generally positive, so feel free to interact and use it. Usually we're doing this live where you can the chat feature is usually going nuts. Right. We average about 200 questions a session, so it's a lot. And again, just feel free to email us any question you may have. There's not a cost to it, guys. So if you ask general tax questions, we're just going to answer them. We don't play the game of let's answer a question then send you a bill. It's just not our style. Anything else you want to say, Jeff?
No, I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving to you and your families.
And until next time, this is Toby and Jeff. Merry Thanksgiving.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.